I teach systematic and philosophical theology at the Lutheran Theological Seminary in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. And this week, I'll be leading 5 sessions on the parables. And looking at the parables, first of all, for their placement within the New Testament, why Jesus uses parables, but also then to look at the whole structure and action of parables, what parables want us to do, how we enact parables within our own church life and within theology, and finally to take a look at precisely why parables are still so interesting. I enjoy teaching the parables because on the one hand, you've heard all of these short little nice stories before and it's so obvious what they mean until someone asks you the question, okay, now what does this parable mean? And all of a sudden you're not quite as confident, you're not quite as sure, and you're saying, I'm not, what does this parable mean? Because the reaction of the disciples every time Jesus told a parable was one of puzzlement, amazement, and it's always recorded in the Gospels, after Jesus told a parable, the 12 or some of the other disciples come up to Jesus and say, okay, now that the crowds are gone, will you tell us what you meant by this parable? So there's that wonderful puzzlement that goes with the parables. And I think that wonderful puzzlement with the parables tell us about the wonderful puzzlement of God's grace, so that as we talk about the parables, we're going to be talking about that wonderfully puzzling thing about God's grace. As introduction, in trying to collect some of my thoughts about parables and summarize them, to me it seems that parables create contrasts, contradictions, dilemmas. They are meant to change and not to reassure us. To follow the logic of a parable is an unnerving experience. One immediate reaction to a parable, according to the biblical scholar John Dominic Crossan, is, I don't know what you mean by that story, but I'm certain I don't like it. Keep that phrase in mind as we look at the spirit. I don't know what you mean by that story, but I'm certain I don't like it. A parable, by creating a contradiction within a given situation, upsets the equilibrium of our complacent, secure, often smug view of things. In understanding a parable, we admit the possibility of contradiction in our world, and we put into question our own reason, our own senses, our own abilities to measure and evaluate what is real. The situation is not what it seems to be in a parable. Everything is radicalized. Our expectations are reversed. Our world is topsy-turvy. Parables keep us humble. We, in shock and astonishment, are compelled to admit that God does not play by our rules. Again, the biblical scholar John Dominic Crossan says, quote, parables remove our defenses and make us vulnerable to God. It is only in such experiences that God can touch us, and only in such moments does the kingdom of God arrive. Parables give God room. Unquote. And a little later tonight, as we look at the Christmas story again, and if you will, the theological conclusions we make from this Christmas story, I think we see too that the Christmas story functions parabolically, in that the Christmas story makes us vulnerable to God. And if you were in the Bible study this morning with Dan Erlander, you may have caught some clues there about that kind of vulnerability. And we'll talk about some more of those. Generally, to look at a parable, Parables usually have a very set kind of structure. And structurally, what a parable does is present a reversal between the usual ordinary structure of a hearer's expectation and the extraordinary structure, the subversive structure, in the parable. And here, just by way of generalization, usually in a parable you have a subject, some kind of action, and there are some consequences. Right, let's take the parable of the Good Samaritan as kind of our parable about parables, because I'm kind of assuming you're all familiar with the basic plot of that story. Right? Well, the Good Samaritan has a subject. Right? That is the Good Samaritan. You can also say the priest and Levites are the subjects there. There are actions. Right? The priest walks by, the Levite walks by, the Samaritan stops and helps. And therefore, there are also consequences. The final consequence of the story is that one is forced, like it or not, and again, remember the context of a Jewish audience. A Jewish audience, like it or not, is forced to call the Samaritan good. All right, that's one of the consequences that come from that action. What happens in a parable is to say, if this is our usual structure of expectations, to say things should work this way, such that you get a subject who, when engaging in good actions, you'll get good consequences, and a subject who engages in negative actions gives you a negative consequence, that's the way things are supposed to work, right? The reversal in a parable comes when, for example, good actions may have negative consequences, or negative actions may have positive consequences. See, and our expectations are reversed. Or you can have, as you can see, all sorts of different understandings. You can have, like, a good subject who would engage in good actions toward some kind of consequence or some type of receiver. A bad subject would engage in negative actions toward some kind of receiver. Here a reversal could be, you know, good people do things that you don't expect them to do, and bad people do the things that you'd expect good people to do. You see how there's always that crisscross, or at least one of these lines. Here within this structure, within this cross, within this reversal of our normal expectations, here's the structure of the parable. And that's what makes us think to say, well, maybe things really don't work that way. Or for sure, it looks like God doesn't work that way. Again, another parable, an obvious example at first, the parable of the shepherd going after the one lost sheep. Who of you, having 100 sheep and losing one, would leave the 99 and go after the one? How many would do that? Why not? That, right? That's not normal. That's not the thing normal people do, right? A good shepherd losing a sheep would what? Stay with the 99 for the positive consequence of what? Taking care of 99. But now, who would say that a good shepherd, or one shepherd that you might want to call good, would what? Leave the 99, do that negative action, and that consequence is considered good. Jesus says, do that. Leave the 99. Go for the one. This Jesus isn't going to be hired as a shepherd. That, what's going on there? That you would leave 99 for one. See, here again is where the parables cause us to think and upset our normal, nice, well-ruled and well-regulated kind of world. And through the week, we'll look at the different parables to see how they want to upset us. And basically, the bottom line on this, in terms of wanting to understand, because all the parables are trying to tell us what the kingdom of God is like. All the parables want to point out how God's rule, how God's gracious reign in the world works. And the conclusion to all of this is, if you look at the parables, that God is radical, subversive, extraordinary, and eccentric. All the things, by and large, we normally don't expect a God to be. How many of us really think about God as being eccentric, weird, out of the ordinary, abnormal? Or is our picture of God that God is the status quo par excellence, that nothing ever upsets God? I mean, God's all the omnis, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, eternal, strong, static, safe, calm, mild-mannered. Well, if that's your normal expectation of God, you're in for a rough week. Because that's not the God and the rule of God that Jesus talks about in the parables. One of the rules for this God, and this is borrowed from Dan in one of his slides that he showed on the Soviet Union, had a little girl who gave him a button that said, "Never be normal." After reading the parables, I'm convinced God wears one of those buttons too. That's one of the rules God seems to live by. Never be normal. Because grace is not something that's normal. And the parables just kind of keep jolting us, because our normal structures of expectation get all reversed and all turned around, and we're all topsy-turvy after reading the parables. The parables, first of all, another way of saying this, the parables, first of all, disorient us in order to reorient us. They push us to the limits of our normal ways of thinking and reasoning and acting, and get us all mixed up and all confused that we're not sure what's right anymore or who's right anymore. And when we're in that kind of dilemma, then they say, okay, now that you're totally confused, we can talk about God and grace. And from that point of confusion, of contradiction, of subverting our normal world views, we can now be reoriented to God's grace. That disorienting function of the parable is what I see as Crossan talking about when he says parables make us vulnerable for God. We have to be shaken up a little bit, and then we can get at parables. Okay, that's kind of the structure of parables. And let me stop here to see if you have any questions or comments about that before we continue. You're all totally disoriented. Okay, part two is to say, given that, given this structure, kind of keep it here in case we want to refer to it, we then come into, use the fancy term here, the word of the day, into the question of hermeneutics. Ah, yes. Fancy word for interpretation, or even a little more accurately, interpretation theory. How do we interpret? When we read something, right? You don't just read it, but you have to interpret it as well. You're trying to understand it, to try to get to some kind of meaning. And so I want to talk a little bit about the whole process of interpretation, very generally, just again to show how the structure of parables fit in here and what they do to our whole process of interpretation. So that once we have this kind of general understanding of parables, a general understanding of what interpretation is all about, then we're ready to look at the Christmas story, then we're ready to look at parables for the rest of the week. When we start out with interpretation, where we begin, and there's basically two beginning points, and they come together in the first step of this whole process. We begin with what I've called our pre-understandings. In other words, who you are before you start reading or hearing a text, and all that you bring with you. Your pre-understanding can involve the assumptions that you have, the presuppositions that you have, the worldview that you hold, the biases that you have, all the previous experiences that you have, and who you are. Being white, middle class, Lutheran, living in 1985, or, yeah, right, that's where I'm living, yeah, in 1988, has all sorts of pre-understandings that go with it. All sorts of pre-understandings that you bring to the reading of a parable that, let's say, Jesus' hearers didn't bring with them at all. We hear the parable of the Good Samaritan, and okay, so we have to call a Samaritan good. Big deal, right? How many of us are scandalized by that? Outraged. Anybody want to kill Jesus after hearing that story? The reaction of Jesus' hearers was that. To say, this is absolutely outrageous. We can't tolerate this. This guy has got to go. So now the kind of thing is, to understand, if you will, again, the scandalousness of the parable of the Good Samaritan. Think about this parable in terms of what if Jesus were, what if Jesus were telling this parable? Only the person who asked him the question was Elliot Abrams from the State Department about, Jesus, could you tell me who is my neighbor? And then Jesus tells this parable about the good Sandinista. That lo and behold, there was a reporter from CBS who was mugged up near the Honduran border. And the Contra walked by because he didn't want to get mugged. And another journalist who had snuck into the country walked by because he didn't want to be discovered. But in comes this FSLN Sandinista, military, godless communist, who stops and helps this reporter from CBS. Now, Mr. Assistant Secretary of State Elliot Abrams, who is the person who showed mercy? And Elliot Abrams, as much as he would hate it, who would detest it, would have to say, I guess there is one good Sandinista. Right? You don't want to say that. He wouldn't want to say that. That's not good politics for his policy. But he's forced to say it. Disgustingly forced to say it. That's the kind of shock that comes in there, because you see, one of the things parables do is they do terrible things to our pre-understandings, that our usual kinds of understanding. We can even, make this a little more dramatic, say all our ideologies are part of our pre-understandings, and they all come under close scrutiny in the parables. The other place we start is what I call the subject matter, and in our case, this is going to be a text, right? We're going to look at certain parts of the Gospels for the parables, but that's the subject matter. the subject of what we're going to look at. And the reason I want to keep it as broad as this is because when we interpret things, we interpret not only things that we read, but things that we hear. Remember, Jesus told these parables. The people didn't read them, but they heard them. But we also interpret things that we see. Think about things going on around you, actions, things like that. The Jesus not only told parables, but Jesus did parabolic actions. Jesus engaged in parabolic deeds. In fact, in the last session, I want to talk a little bit about how all of Jesus' life can be understood as parabolic. But so what were the first thing that happens in our interpretation theory is that our pre-understandings come up against the subject matter or the text. And so there's already now a dialogue, a discussion, a conversation that goes on between those two. And as you, as let's say the reader of a parable, start discussing what that parable is all about, the first thing that emerges from that is explanation. And by explanation here, you're trying to make sense out of something. As you look at the parable, you want to say, does this parable make sense? Is what I am reading or hearing or seeing, does it make sense? That's the first thing we try to do whenever we read or understand something. Because if it doesn't make sense, it's going to be very hard to get to the next step of understanding. Because how can you understand something if you can't make sense out of it? And the wonderful thing about the parables, again, is this often leaves this notion in question. Do the parables make sense? Does it make sense that a shepherd should leave 99 sheep and go after one? The first thing you'd have to say to that, the obvious answer is no, it doesn't make. It makes no sense whatsoever. And so then you push to the next level to say, well, does this mean that Jesus is telling us senseless stories? That he's making up things that make no sense whatsoever? That it's all gibberish? That it's like Lewis Carroll's Jabberwocky? And it's just kind of talking things together, and Jesus is saying, okay, what story could I think of today to tell them that will make no sense whatsoever, but people for 2,000 years are going to knock their heads out over it? Ah, good idea. That makes Jesus a kind of malicious person, wouldn't it? So with that understanding, right, a pre-understanding that says, no, Jesus is not a malicious person, not the kind of person who would want to tell us something that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, it pushes us more into saying, okay, how do these parables make sense? And that's the first thing we are engaged in then, in the interpretation of those parables. To try to make sense out of them and to have them make sense. The first thing that forces us into is into the context of the parable. Because how are we going to make sense of this parable? How can we explain it if we can't understand the context and the setting in which that all happened? So in order to understand a parable, to have it make some sense for us, we need to know the setting, the audience, the people to whom Jesus was talking. What were the issues? What were their pre-understandings as they came to think? What were Pharisees thinking about? What were the common Jewish people thinking about? What were the Romans thinking about? Once you can get that kind of setting and that context, we can begin to make sense out of it. But that isn't where we stop. Unfortunately, a lot of people in terms of biblical interpretation says, okay, once we can make sense out of it, And once we can tell you what it meant to the people back then, now our job is over. And in many respects, now our job has just begun. Because once we can make sense of the parable, now comes the point of understanding. To say, okay, now that we can see that it makes sense, what does it mean for us? So this is now trying to say, we pull that context and that meaning of the parable, what does that mean for us in our context? And once we begin to understand what that means for us in our context, now you can see the understandings that we come to, and perhaps the pre-understandings that we started with come into conflict with one another. Because, see, here our expectations and the meaning of the parable don't end up at the same place. So something has to change. You see, here is where the parable enables us to make room in our pre-understandings for God. Here's now where the parable opens up that space within our own assumptions and worldviews and biases and experiences and tells us, you see, God doesn't play by our rules. Grace is something different than the way you usually expect and live and work and associate with one another. And that now means that the pre-understandings that you started with before you worked with that parable are now, once you have reached an understanding of that parable, they are going to change. So that what a parable eventually will end up doing is re-describing reality for you in a new and different way. That's the reorienting. That's how the parable will disorient your pre-understandings and in the end up reorienting them to show this different way, this eccentric, extraordinary, surprising way that God works in the world. Okay, any questions, comments? This is kind of the general theory here on both parables and how we interpret, and I hope to have brought in a little bit to see what parables do to the way we normally interpret. Yes?
When you move from the explanation to the understanding, it's possible you could have many different understandings.
Mm-hmm.
The meaning might be different depending on the context of each individual. Is that what you're saying here?
The meaning, what it means for us in our context, can be different for individuals, but I'm also would put it at a larger level to say in terms of communities or different groups. To ask what the parable means for us in our context, to take a kind of radical understanding, we within the United States would understand the parable of the Good Samaritan differently than, let us say, if that parable were told in Nicaragua. Because for us, the shock value might be in talked about the Good Sandinista. In Nicaragua, the shock value might be in terms of telling the story about the Good Contra. So, again, the structure of the parable always allows for some diversity of understanding. That's why they're always rich.
Wouldn't your arrow then really go from explanation to pre-understanding and then to new understanding? That is, the explanation bumps up against the conceptual structure you have, and out of that emerges a new thing. That is different than the old one.
Right. The understanding you come to could be different than the old pre-understanding you had. The reason that I would prefer to keep it in this kind of order is that to want to kind of take the shortcut to back to the pre-understanding is because in many respects, explanation and trying to make sense out of it and trying to understand it within their context need not necessarily upset your pre-understandings. See, because it mean back then. How did those people understand it? And one can be, at that point, yet relatively objective. I'll put objective in quotation marks. In other words, not particularly feel threatened yet by the story. But now when you ask, what does this mean for me? Right now the story could get a little tight around your pre-understanding and your world, and it might rub and conflict and subvert and want to change it. And so that's why I would want to keep it in this order.
Well, the reason I mentioned that is that learning theory would say that I learn something new when my previous way of looking at something seems inadequate and won't satisfy anymore, won't explain things the way it used to. And out of that can emerge something new. So that when you come to a new understanding, it also involves you in a re-examination of the old almost simultaneously. So somehow the explanation bumping against the old understanding and a new understanding emerging needs to be portrayed. That's my own.
Okay. One reason I put the diagram like this is because this is what others who have studied this, going even back as far as Heidegger and Bultmann, would call this the hermeneutical circle. Right? This is a circular process in terms of, you know, once this comes into your pre-understanding, you just don't stop here. But if you will, that keeps going the next time you read it and the next time you read it and whatever you bump into again and again and again. Right? To use a totally different example, and maybe with the learning theory understanding, to say, how does one learn mathematics? Again, with starting with some pre-understandings, they get the subject matter. You explain addition, they understand what that means, and you build on that to go through subtraction, multiplication, algebra, trigonometry, calculus, see? Building on those things.
That's a different type of learning. I think creative learning that emerges in new understandings and insights is always conflictual. That is, something new bumps into what is old, and out of it emerges something I never thought of before. And that's why the nice logical circle doesn't quite grab the dynamics of the conflict. Maybe you need a new thing between after understanding and pre-understanding. There's arrows going both ways, and they're bumping up against one another, and bam, out of that comes something different.
Sure, that's no. I mean, I won't argue with that. I mean, in terms of to say, yes, in this structure from understanding, as that comes back into your pre-understanding. Obviously, if there's something in your pre-understanding that is going to change, that there's going to be some kind of new. One would talk about, yeah, the conflict going on between understanding what that means for us and what I used to think that used to mean. Mm-hmm. Right, that can be looked at as conflictual or creative.
And then the circle starts again.
I mean, you know, this is a general overview, but what I would claim is that this general overview does take into account what you've been saying. And in terms of having that new experience, yes, that's precisely, if you will, a battle between understanding and pre-understanding here. That kind of conflict. Rather than over here in the part on explanation. If you will, from a theological point of view, what happens over here one could say is exegesis, trying to explain the text over here about what that means for us in our context. One might want to call that homiletics, the art of preaching.
Or education.
Or education. Right. But the good, the pastor on Sunday morning should not be taking you back onto his her workshop and desk and say, now let me tell you about all the word studies I did and all the articles that I looked up, and you see, here are the different nuances of this Greek word. Helpful, right? Important to understand that text, but not particularly enlightening to people on Sunday morning. On Sunday morning, it's taking this and saying, okay, given all this stuff, here's the understanding, here's the living word for us, here's the good news of the gospel to our community on this day, as we hear and think again about that parable of Jesus.
However, that ought to clash with some of the pre-understandings, and everybody ought to walk out of there saying, aha, something new has happened to me. Everybody ought to walk out of there at the end of this week saying, something new has happened to me. And that in bumping between old and new. And so maybe you need a fifth thing in the middle.
In the best of all possible worlds, I would certainly hope that something new happens this week. But that's up for you. That's up for you. Someone else was going to say something. I didn't mean to cut you off.
I just said let you proceed with your process, and then the next time somebody can have a different process.
I think this
process looks good because each one of us have experienced something with the same text and reading it, that then we have a new understanding, and then we start a new process, and that adds to our free understanding for the next time we go into it.
Mm-hmm. I think Jesus up in heaven having a little laugh at us now, because I don't think he wanted us to go through all this bits to try and understand what he said.
Okay, if he didn't want us to try to understand what he said, why did he tell us anything?
Well, I don't know, but this whole bit here seemed a little bit complicated. I've never had that much trouble understanding the parable.
Good for you.
Especially the parable of the Good Samaritan. That's no problem for me to understand.
Okay.
One response I have, I have no trouble understanding the call to be good to the neighbor, but when a word comes to me of somebody I hate that is held up as good, then my whole insides grind against it. Then what the parable is meant to do is starting to work.
Okay. Let's kind of keep some of this in mind and take a few minutes to look at some of the Christmas story and some parts of to first ask how many of you were in Dan Erlander's Bible study this morning and took a look at Luke 2? About half. Okay. Let's then shift and do a little work in Matthew to start out, and to look at Matthew chapter 1, verses 18 through 25. Okay, if you looked at that, let's just look at this to see in terms of structure and that. In Matthew 8, verse 1, 18 through 25, chapter 1, verses 18 through 25. Who's the subject or subjects? Maybe we should start out simply by asking, who are the characters?
Joseph.
Okay, we've got Joseph. Anyone else?
Mary.
Got Mary. Anyone else? The Holy Spirit.
Angel.
An angel.
Jesus.
Jesus. Anyone else? Should we have them all? Okay. Who's the subject? Who's the main subject of this story?
Jesus.
Joseph?
Oh, I think we're trying to convince Joseph here. Joseph's trying to do the right thing and divorce Mary.
Yeah, Joseph.
She's in trouble somehow. You're not quite sure how, but I think he's.
Okay, Joseph. Anyone else? We've narrowed it down to. It's either, at least the only two options I heard, is it's either Joseph or Jesus that are the chief characters of this story. Okay, well, let's try to look at it in terms of what's the action in this story. Now, let's again just start by listing. What are the actions going on here? I can't hear.
You're sleeping and dreaming.
All right. There's an action of dreaming.
Composition of divorce, or like.
All right. There's some notion in here of divorce.
Conception. Decision.
Betrothing.
Commanding.
Delivering a message.
Okay, that's probably along with commanding. I'll just say commanding, delivering.
Fulfilling. Naming.
Birthing. I was just going to say, isn't it interesting? Here we're talking about the Christmas story and no one's even talked about birth yet.
It's abstention as well.
Abstention. Okay. Lots of action. Now the easy question, right? Which is the primary action?
Which was about fulfilling.
So you want to kind of have us remember a little bit dreaming, but say that leads us to fulfilling. All right.
Sure.
It's called being diplomatic. All right. What about the consequences? What are the consequences?
God's will.
I'm sorry. Just
God's will.
Joseph took Mary for his wife.
Okay. Joseph married Mary. God's will is done.
Prophecy fulfilled.
All right. Is that part of God's will is done? That's the same as fulfilled. Prophecy fulfilled. Or you want to make that, do you understand that in a very different way? All right. Anyone else? Any consequences? Okay. Child is named.
They say Joseph changed his mind.
All right, that's part of the marrying Mary, maybe. All right. Which one of these do you see to be the primary consequence?
The prophecy is fulfilled.
The prophecy is fulfilled. Anyone else here?
I think we missed something in action. We forgot obedience. Because Joseph did as God had commanded him. And if he hadn't, there wouldn't have been the consequence. There wouldn't have been the same consequence.
Okay, obedience. And then you would also like to claim that that is the primary action.
Well, sure.
I don't want to put words in your... I mean, it's your Christmas. I wouldn't want to ruin your Christmas.
Sure. I'll go for that.
You'll go for obedience. Obediently going for obedience.
Well, the consequence of this, the first verse says, this is how the birth of Jesus Christ came about. Consequence was the birth of Christ. So it was the action, but it's also the birth.
Okay, child is born. And so you want to say this is the primary consequence.
We're going to say
you're helping us stand the law. You're showing us that we really don't know. Okay, anyone else? All right, given still the options that we have here, how might you try to diagram this? All you who think that biblical study is easy, now. But it's good. We've got all our options out here. How would you begin to diagram this?
Well, you could start by saying Joseph, a good man, so subject plus.
Okay, so
does an action that would normally be considered negative, marries a pregnant woman, or agrees to marry her even though she's not pregnant by him. So that's A minus.
Okay, so if we're just going to work it, just start kind of this way, to say Joseph, the good man, does...
abnormal or...
what is considered an abnormal action.
And the opening the way for a good consequence.
Opening the way, then that leads to the consequence. Okay, and in that we would have a reversal, because usually a good man, you wouldn't expect to do that kind of extraordinary thing. You wouldn't call it wrong, but certainly a good man in many respects wouldn't marry a girl that got herself into trouble.
Well, it says so Joseph, being a good man, decided to put her away quietly, so that would have been the normal thing.
Right. Yeah, the normal action would be to just, you know, kind of get out of that contract and go on with your life, but keep it quiet. But you did something out of the ordinary there. Okay, that might be one way of doing it. Anyone else? Particularly if you think the main subject is Jesus and some of these other notions are in here.
Well, if you do it this way, if you have God being the subject, or the Holy Spirit, and the action he takes would be two questionable ones, having an unmarried woman get pregnant, and then having this man marry her anyway, two possible extraordinary actions, coming out with a consequence of Jesus' birth.
Okay, so that would kind of be the subject, God, who could kind of act normally or act abnormally, right? And that the normal way of acting could give you, you would think, positive consequences, the abnormal way, negative. And here, God acting in an eccentric manner, telling Joseph, marry this girl anyway, do right by her, so on and so forth and so on, leads to a positive consequence. So here Joseph was the subject. Here we have the subject is God. But the reversal still comes in this surprising kind of way. Let's keep this in mind and go to this setup to say, okay, has anything happened so far in all of this that any of your pre-understandings and so on and so forth, by looking at it in this manner, have been a little bit upset, topsy-turvy? Have you been challenged? Or is this still the same nice old stuff we always do?
When I was in Sunday school, this was never considered a parable, this story. I just realized as I was reading it that it was very shocking to me to even consider this story as a parable. I guess I have a very narrow definition of the word.
Mm-hmm. Right. We're looking at this, if you will, particularly as a parabolic action by God, right, in terms of that kind of, the kind of structure we're talking about here.
Well, really, this is what God normally does. I mean, God usually takes the worst possible character and makes him the hero. You know, Moses, the murderer, all these people that do the, you know, are weak and have all these problems. God picks those people to bring forth something new, and that's exactly what he did here. He took, you know, unwed mother and almost unwed, and plain old carpenter. The lowly circumstances, and he brings forth the king.
Neither one of them are bad guys, you know.
They're not bad. They're just ordinary. But he doesn't pick the queen or anything like that to do it.
No, that's true.
And that's not, is that surprising to you, or is that pretty normal?
Well, I think for God it would be normal. He always does that kind of strange thing.
So God is simply normally strange.
Eccentric. That's your
eccentric. And anything else in terms of, has anything happened here yet to notions of you as understanding just this part of Matthew in this way to change any of the pre-understandings or experiences or your normal preconceptions of Christmas? This isn't a very sentimental story at all. But it's great material for small town gossip, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can you imagine the other women as they're getting water in the morning saying, "Do you know what's going on between Joseph and Mary? She's looking kind of big. I think she's pregnant. They're not married yet, are they? What's going on?" I mean, this kind of has a dynasty ring to it.
One thing that kind of struck me is it begins and it says that Mary had been betrothed to Joseph. Now, they are not yet married. But yet further on down, unwilling to put her to shame, resolved to divorce her quietly. So there must have been some sort of a formal arrangement.
And this is a question where we would get into the context of that and understanding that the whole process is there, that one is betrothed and, if you will, contracts are set up between the husband's family or the husband marrying and the father of the bride and so on and so forth.
Maybe they could sleep together, but they have a bundling. And
the divorce notion is there, is that the betrothal or that engagement is annulled because what? Joseph has discovered damaged goods. Right, literally. Because again, within the context, women are basically property, and Joseph would be buying damaged goods at this point. Right? And if you're getting damaged goods, it's certainly fair and feasible that you can return damaged merchandise.
It says he's a just man and unwilling to put her to shame, so he was going to divorce her quietly.
Mm-hmm.
By divorcing her quietly, would there then not be shame?
She wouldn't be stoned.
She wouldn't be killed.
She wouldn't, right. She would not be killed and he would not be embarrassed. If it could be kept quiet, there wouldn't be any shame. No, Joseph at least, could proclaim his innocence in all of this. And if there's any shame left, well, that's Mary's problem. One thing to have you think about here, and this is again kind of explanation within the context and within Matthew's understanding and that in terms of why he picked out what he did in the Christmas story. in terms of consequences. I think for Matthew, the primary consequence is that the child is named. Because again, within the Hebrew understanding, a person's name really designates who that person is. And what is important here is that the child is named Emmanuel, God with us. And throughout the entire Gospel of Matthew, the high points of all the places in Matthew's stories and in Matthew's Gospel, this God with us comes in. It's right here at the beginning. Jesus is born and is named what? God with us. The very end of Matthew is the commissioning of the disciples, go out and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them. And it ends with a promise. And that promise is what?
I will be with you always.
I am with you always till the end of the age. So from the very birth to the ascension of Jesus, this becomes the motif. This is the naming. This is the consequence, the good news of Christmas.
This is just a small question, but why does it say his name should be called Emmanuel, and the last line is he called his name Jesus? Why are there two?
Because here, at least in this understanding, God with us, being Emmanuel and being also called Jesus, or in Hebrew, Joshua, means God will save, God will deliver. So how will God deliver? God will deliver by being with us.